This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action New York's Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution Free Revolution. Joining us this morning is Henry Lickers. He is a scientist with the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne's Department of the Environment. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
We're doing good now that we're talking. And we had just been talking prior to beginning the recording about the differences between the, you know, basically the kind of people, you know, the way the First Nations people are and the way the people of the, you know, the recent Western civilization are. Let's jump right on that. Tell us about your perceptions on this matter.
One of the things that we see is that, you know, I've grown up as a traditional person with my family and doing ceremonies and integrating the environment in my lifestyle. And what we've noticed is that in the it's hard to talk about the Western society, but this whole problem that you have and we have with the Earth, we found that as people in the beginning, when your people first arrived in North America, they saw this bright new place to live. And at that time, they saw how they would have to live with the land and how they'd have to do these different things to be able to survive here. And so their lifestyle was integrated into the environment. And as such, they then appreciated the environment. And so much of the early writings of the, we'll say, the pioneers and those type of people talk about this wonderful place in which they found. What we think has happened is that as the people grew and the populations grew, there was whole groups of people that removed themselves from the environment. And, you know, those are the people that don't see the environment as being, you know, part of their lifestyle. And so as they moved into these cities, they removed themselves more and more and more from the environment, and suddenly they got to a point where, you know, I think it was Paul Ehrlichman said that, you know, the economists are the only people in the world that believes the world runs by magic. And whereas the Haudenosaunee people, or my people, I'm a Seneca Turtle clan, our lifestyle is integrated into the environment. And when you integrate your lifestyle into the environment, certain things become obvious to you. One of them is that the earth is your mother. And so if you're going to live on this earth, you have to take care of it. You have to be mindful of it and respectful of it. And so you can see that as people remove themselves from the environment, they no longer believe that the earth was their mother, and they no longer believe that they had to care about it. And suddenly you see this huge expansion of industry, and environment really looked at them as a nuisance. And so I think that's one of the basic differences I see between what I would call those societies that live close to the environment and those societies that have removed themselves from the environment.
Yes.
And this occurs all over the world. It's not just here in North America.
And so in a society such as your own, the Haudenosaunee, you know, the Seneca, the Iroquois, it would never, your people would never encounter what our people, you know, I'm part of the Western civilization, what I am encountering in my society, you would never encounter, and let's talk about why, you know, just to kind of double up on what you're saying, but also to expand upon it, with regards to this problem that I find very, you know, troubling. And you've touched upon it with this matter of increasing industrialization and more and more factories and the emissions from these sources. The problem that I find truly just so unacceptable and just so painful and just so great a difficulty is this matter of having the corporations being so dominant in our society. You know, here in the Western society, here in New York State, even locally, truly, Alco is very, very powerful, and the big corporate farms are very powerful. We find so much of what we try to do to be, you know, resisted by the corporations when it comes to bringing change that protects the earth and protects the public health by reducing, you know, the presence of these contaminants in the environment. Talk to me, you know, tell me why, you know, talk to me about Native corporations and about, you know, their the kind of like the position that, say, corporate entities that are, you know, founded in First Nations endeavors and with First Nations people involved. You know, what's the difference?
Well, one of the things that you find with them is that, again, they come from a perspective that's the in which they're the culture and the lifestyle of the people have been nested in that environment. And so many of the things that they actually do are reflective of how that world works and perceives it. So the first thing you'd have to say is that if I'm nested deep into the world, you know, and I look on the earth as my mother, I look on, what as they say, knowledge is powerful, but we say only if it's shared. And suddenly you're into this society or world in which everything that's in the world is related to you. So with the Mohawks and with the Haudenosaunee people, we have a prayer that's called, or not a prayer, but a greeting, introduction, if you want, that's called the words that come before all else. And what that does, it's like something that I would say every morning when I wake, and it goes through talking about the people, talking about the Mother Earth, the water, the fishes, the plants, different types of plants, the animals, the birds, the weather that's around me, the sun, the moon, and the stars, you know, the spiritual world, acknowledging my teachers and talking about the Creator. That's our Thanksgiving. That's our address to the world that me, just as a simple person, would do in the morning when I wake and in the evening when I sleep. When we would have a meeting, let's say an important meeting like we just had here at Akwesasne, one of us would be chosen to give that greetings and thanksgiving. And we would stand up and we would tell everybody why these things were important, and people would acknowledge the greeting. So it's sort of like when I go to non-Native conferences, scientific conferences, you know, I see no reflection of the spirit of the people. And so not only have the Western society pulled themselves out of the environment, but then they pulled themselves right out of the concept of spirituality and the spirit itself. And so, you know, even in a greeting, you know, hello, how are you? The simple act of asking how a person is important to the Haudenosaunee. We say, Seiko. And what that means is, how goes the way of peace with you? Mm-hmm. And so right away in the language itself is centered all these things that are concentrating on how you are living with the environment around you. Okay. So now you want to be a Native businessman. Well, a Native businessman is working in relationship to many other people. And so with that, we have a tool called the Great Way of Peace. My grandmother used to translate it as the way to be nice. And in that, it's very simple. It can be translated into three words. You know, the concepts that you have to balance are the concepts of respect, equity, and empowerment. Now, you think about a business model of this, and that means you don't drive your competition out of business because you need your competition to see innovation and different things. You need to respect them. The equity that you're looking for is knowledge and networks and those type of things, and then you empower yourselves to be able to go out and do these things. And so a Haudenosaunee businessman is really looking to the community around him to support him, but he also is looking to see how he can support his community. And so we'll say polluting your environment, doing a bad job is considered, you know, bad business.
Yeah.
Because you're hurting the very people that could help you.
This is just, all we need to do is figure out how to get the Western civilization to change its mind and, you know, change its behavior and just do as your culture does. Things would fall into place. You know, it's not too late by any means of the world. I'm sure the Earth is very, very resilient. And there's no doubt that if people were in large numbers to start living the way you live and the, you know, the Akwesasne Mohawk live, then, and doing business the way they do business, having corporations that are based on that model you just described, the things would, you know, heal. There'd be restoration. The earth would just, you know, bounce right back and public health would improve and people's individual health, you know, being, you know, people's individual health would improve and that would improve public health. We wouldn't have all these awful problems with diabetes and cancer and cardiovascular disease and depression and these mental disorders, and we just wouldn't see all this, these bad results that come from the bad behaviors that involved this, you know, lack of concern for the Mother Earth and, you know, willingness just to, you know, fight with each other and cheat each other and, you know, drive each other out of business and just make a lot of money and poison the earth and poison each other and just, you know, this thing of greed, just the Bible, you know, I'm not Christian, but I think there were some very, very wise things written down in the Bible, as there are in other, you know, all these religious texts. And when they said that the love of money was the root of all evil, that certainly goes a long way toward explaining what exists right now with what we're talking about, this matter of the Earth Mother having been, you know, wrecked. Well, not wrecked. I don't want to say wrecked. Just harmed. Harmed a lot, but not wrecked by any means. I know the Earth can, and the people can rebound from this and be just fine. You know, in a, it'll take a considerable period of time, you know, maybe like 100 years or, you know, 150 years, some significant number of generations passing and the, you know, the Earth being able to just kind of gradually have less poison that's active and, you know, right up in the, you know, the parts of the biosphere that we're all exposed to on a regular basis. So I think what we need to do is just figure out how, and you guys are really doing it by setting the good example that is certainly, you know, taking the steps toward bringing all the rest of people, you know, onto this path with you. And you were just telling me before we went on the record about the APTN, that's the Aboriginal People's Television Network, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, you told me about them doing a story about the people at Akwesasne. So there will be, how, what's this, what is this story about, and how can other people, you know, Western people, you know, watch it and learn from it and start moving toward changing?
Well, one of the, like, what happens here at Akwesasne is the message that we're giving to the people is that here is a community of Mohawk people who live in the middle of the St. Lawrence, probably the open sewer of the Great Lakes, if you want to put
exactly.
it that way, you know, with tons of contaminants, over 130 coming down the river. And, you know, and yet this group of people who exist here still utilize the resource around them, still hold to their cultural beliefs and opinions, and are very strong in them. And, it, you know, you would say to yourself, oh, that's impossible. They're, you know, it's doomed. Well, it's not doomed, as long as people hold to their principles and to what they believe in. And so, again, when you APTN came here, I think they expected to find sometimes when you hear people talk, a depressed area, you know, where everybody's feeling horrible and unemployment rampant and, you know, kids all upset and drugs and all of those type of things, because that's what we expect to hear from our press. Our press is, expects to speak about all the horrible things in our in community. I, talking to them, you, what they found was, here we're a whole bunch of vibrant people with a whole bunch of hope, working as hard as they can against some severe problems, but still trying to move forward in this society that sometimes didn't even regard them as human beings. So, you know, maybe what is the difference here? What is the thing that allows us to maintain, you know, this level of dignity, and I'll call it dignity, and what allows us to do that is the deep, deep connection that we have to the earth, and that when we see things that are damaging the earth or our brothers and sisters, the animals and plants, this is not something that we can set aside. We are responsible for this. We have a responsibility to it. And this, I find, is most peculiar in the Western society, because if I ask somebody in the Western society, you know, why should you take care of the fish? They say, well, we have a right to put contaminants into the river. We have a right under law to put this much stuff into the river. We have a right to build a dam because that's what we have a right to do, and that we're following all the laws. Well, when you do that, the problem with that type of structure is that then you need 1,500 lawyers, you need courts, you need systems that will police and do all of these type of things in order to make sure, supposedly, that the world is protected. But then when you look at the law, what you find is that because of all the compromise you make, suddenly all you're doing is protecting to the minimum.
Right.
But allowing the contaminant to go to the maximum.
Yep.
So it's always interesting to me that, you know, a person who works on responsibility, we have a responsibility to the world. Why would I put PCBs into the system? Even if I didn't know about the toxicity, something that I would put into the system that would persist for maybe hundreds of years, to me sounds really quite strange that somebody would put that into the system.
Yep.
And not think about the consequences.
Yep.
In a rights-based
okay.
system, though, where you have laws and things like that, oh, yes, I can put 0.001 parts per million into the system because that's what the law says and that's my right. But that's only the minimum level of protection.
Yep. And the fact of the matter is, getting, you know, just expanding a little on what you were, you know, saying a moment ago, these laws, they are based in so little science and they based in so little, you know, former experience as far as knowing that it was, you know, a good level to set and that it was, you know, going to turn out all right, that this will be a safe level of having, you know, pollution emitted at and dumped at and discharged at. And it all falls apart. It's the fact of the matter is these levels are more, they're more the levels that can be attained by the technology rather than there being anything health protective about them. You know, it's just that, you know, we have a piece of equipment that can, you know, do this work in a way that puts out this much pollution. Well, then that's the level that the law says is allowed to be put out. Not the fact that, well, there's this pollution and it's going to harm things and we've studied this and we understand the effects and it'll be safe. We'll have a margin of safety if we only put out such and such an amount. That is not the way the law, you know, was created. It's not what the law does. And so we get this situation where all these sources of pollution are putting out the pollution that their equipment is capable of, you know, reducing down to the level of it being put out at, with no science involved as to whether it's healthy or not. You put all that together, and it's certainly turning out to be that it's very unhealthy to have that much pollution in our world. Wow. We're getting a little farther afield on these matters, and I think I'm so glad that we just are doing it this way, but I want to pull it back a little bit to what I had originally intended to interview you on. You were speaking on a talk show with the WCKO, and it's one of your, you know, First Nations people's radio networks. You're speaking on that talk show with Craig Arquette, who is with the Akwesasne Task Force for the Environment, and with David O'Carpenter, MD, who is with SUNY Albany Institute for Health and Environment. And the subject of the talk show were these persistent organic pollutants and how they've harmed the First Nations people in Akwesasne, and this whole matter of body burden and beginning to see, as the science has been accumulating now for several decades, really, there's been a lot of good science accumulating on POPs and adverse health effects for, say, at least 30, 40 years. And especially lately, there's been a real kind of, there's a growing pace of research being published and the good quality of the research. And you three were talking about how this relates to Akwesasne and how the studies have been done there and that more research was coming along and that the picture was clear that people who have body burdens of these chemicals do experience adverse health effects. And you mentioned during this talk show, when you were speaking, you said that it had been the case at Akwesasne that people began to look at the PCBs and wonder about them and talk about them and try to do something about them when First Nations people were observing the disappearance of wildlife species. Can you tell me some more about that? Because this is what I'm very interested in hearing more of, together with our, you know, a broader discussion of, you know, the different cultures.
Within Akwesasne around the 1970s, or literally from the, actually probably the 50s, when the Seaway was finished building here. With the Seaway came a lot of hydroelectric power, and with the hydroelectric power came a lot of industry because you got cheap power here.
Yep.
And from those industries, you know, they all had different compounds that they were producing as toxins and pumping them into the river or into the air as well. And so what you saw here was is not just one or two contaminants, organics or inorganics. You had fluoride contamination, you had the PCBs, you had various other compounds, dioxins, in the river. So Akwesasne was worried because one of the things they noticed was is that the disappearance of bees on Cornwall Island. And what you found is when you do research that bees are quite susceptible to fluoride, which was an airborne contaminant. You started to know behavioral differences in, for example, frogs and we'll say shrews and things like this on the land. You began to notice that things like mink disappeared. Well, mink are very susceptible to PCBs. And so here you have a group of people who are nested in the environment,
yep,
keen observers of the wildlife,
right,
and suddenly they're seeing a change.
Yep.
And so to carry that on, what happened was is that the people then began to petition their governments in saying, what's happening? We're noticing our cattle are failing. We noticed that, like I said, the bees, upland game birds on Cornwall Island were disappearing. We've noticed that there are no more mink here. All of these type of changes. The other thing that they said was, what are these industries doing? Domtar at that time had been here for a long time. There were rayon and material on the North Shore, Reynolds Metals, Alcoa, General Motors on the South Shore. And they seem to be disregarding and just sort of throwing everything into the river. And the people saying, well, what is the effect of this? And so in 1976, not long after EPA was established or Environment Canada was established, the Department of the Environment at the Mohawk Council was established. And it was to look at many of those same questions. And so as we looked at the wildlife, we began to see different impacts and effects. Now we're saying to ourselves, what's the impact on humans since we're eating those animals,
okay,
since we're depending upon our gardens in order to live in this area? And again, now you get into the really complex science of this stuff where, you know, you just can't go out with a barometer and find out how healthy the people are. You have to have you know, very, very complex systems that you can look at and investigations, and the answers aren't so clear that you can see them really, really evident. And that was one of the big problems with these studies that we've done on humans and looking at them. The David Carpenter work is work that's been run over 20 years of looking at the people and seeing what's happened and where it could be targeted back to as far as contaminants are concerned. We've done a huge health study here on people looking at PCBs, Myrex, mercury, and fluoride in the system, and, you know, seeing what we could identify as symptoms that may be found that are different in people at Akwesasne than others. And there were a number of different symptoms that we could find that were directly associated with exposure, but also indirectly related to exposures. And so, again, all of this information and data that we have collected at Akwesasne, and remember, this is a Native community. You know, we have people who are skilled in being able to do this work, but we've had to develop that over a period of time. And the reason that the society would do that is because of our deep connection and cultural connection to the environment around us. So if our brothers and sisters are being impacted, the animals and the plants, then we must be impacted. and we decided that we should go look for these impacts. And that began a long story of our people looking for these things in our own people.
You mentioned a project called the EAGLE Project. Tell us what EAGLE, you know, what that acronym stands for, and then let's get into, I have been reading some about the EAGLE Project. I'm particularly interested in the Contaminants in Human Tissues program, and that report that was published, titled, I think it was called EAGLE Project, Contaminants in Human Tissues. It was published in May 2001 by Health Canada. Tell us about the EAGLE Project, Henry.
Well, the EAGLE Project stemmed out of the work here we've done at Akwesasne. I was one of the principal investigators with Health Canada, Dr. Brian Wheatley. But the question was, is EAGLE stands for the effects on Aboriginals in the Great Lakes Basin. It was to examine that. So EAGLE was the acronym for it.
Okay.
But it looked at 73 communities across the Great Lakes that, eat fish, that live in close to their environment like we do. And could we tease out of that larger population some idea of what was happening in the environment? As you can be well aware, it was looked on with great trepidation by the epidemiologists and some of the other scientists. You know, could Native people actually do this type of work? We began, first looking at animal tissues like we've done, and we found, a host of contaminants right across the Great Lakes. And then we moved from there to who was eating it, looking at nutrition studies and things like that, and then finally ending up taking human tissues and seeing if we could find those compounds in the native population in the Great Lakes. And what happened is, yes, we can. We can find those, and they correlate with what the people eat, which, again, is what you would expect.
Okay. Now tell me, I've read I've read the important part of the executive summary of this. It's the EAGLE Project, Contaminants in Human Tissues. It was published in May 2001 by Health Canada. And the finding, as far as in my mind goes, the key findings were that, yes, these chemicals are present in First Nations. And I think the chemicals that they said were most frequently found were several PCBs, quite a number of PCB carcinogens, and then the DDE, which is a breakdown product of DDT, that old pesticide, the DDT, and then this trans-non-achlor and toxaphene and mercury. So basically the First Nations people in the Great Lakes Basin all have, it's likely that all of them, considering the fact that this study found it was frequent that these chemicals were in their bodies, large numbers of the First Nations people in Great Lakes Basin have that group of chemicals, at the very least, in their bodies, the body burden. Levels were higher back in the several past decades than maybe they are with some of them now, but these levels are certainly going up for other chemicals of this nature, these persistent organic pollutants, the PCBs, the DDE, the DDT, the trans-non-achlor, the toxaphene, they're all POPs, these persistent organic pollutants.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fluoride, as you mentioned with your people here at Akwesasne, probably not as high in other populations, but your population certainly. And fluoride being a metal, it's something that's going to last for forever. And then the mercury being a metal, and that's in all these people, these First Nations in this Great Lakes Basin. But then Health Canada, as far as very important statement in this document, they state that the contaminant levels observed were not associated with any adverse health effects. What is your response to that?
Well, one of the things is that the problems is with epidemiology in general, is that, if you have a large number of people, the dose response has to be so high in order to correlate a disease, let's call it a disease, with the dose. We've seen this, for example, in cigarette smoking, where, it's taken literally years and millions of people's studies in order to say that there's a link between smoking
right.
and cancer.
Yep.
you know, just a phenomenal number. So how are you going to determine that there's a link between a group of people who have, you know, 15, 20, 30 different types of compounds in them and some disease at the end of this process?
Right.
And that's what I think the statement from Health Canada is saying is that they are used to dealing with single contaminants. They're not used to dealing with mixtures. And it's for them, it's very difficult to find out which one caused what. Now, what I would say to you, though, is that if you look at the society, if you look at the group of people, and you see them with all of these compounds in them, and you know that, yes, they suffer from a great deal of things, you have to look at their lifestyle. You have to look at how they function in relation to other people. And what we found here, again, at Akwesasne was that you can't get down to a medical dysfunction, but you start to see trends that are worrying and that we should be worried about.
Right.
With David Carpenter's work, you know, they saw behavioral problems, but that's only after 20 years of work.
Yes.
And so, again, what is happening here is that the native people in the Great Lakes are almost acting like canaries in the mine. You know, we watch them over a long period of time, and I'm really happy that are my own people doing that. But what happens is that you're now watching these, have to watch these over decades. And what other society can maintain that type of watch over their own people other than one that is so intimately bound up with the environment to look for those long-term trends? So with the Eagle Project, it was sort of the beginning of our identifying these type of things among our people. And we've continued those studies in many different other communities and communities within the Great Lakes. And it's only now, after many, many years, that we're being able to tease out some of the implications. At Anjanon, for example, near Sarnia, Ontario, they noticed that as the years went on, they had a predominance of female births in the community and a lack of male births. Now, that doesn't sound like, you know, a big deal, except that we know that the feminization of, for example, amphibians and different things from these type of pops is one of the things that you look for. Well, if you have a whole population of people that normally will say are 50-50 males and females, suddenly end up with 75% females and 25% males, I don't know what the actual numbers are, but I know that they were significant, you suddenly start to worry, because these pops can have that effect on what I would call the native animal population. Well, to us, we're just another animal that lives within the environment. So if you're starting to see that type of indication, what else is occurring? You know, and this is what worries us, because here we are, a group of people who are most tied to the environment. What about our brothers and sisters? What about the non-native people that are living in our area? They seem complacent about the changes that may be occurring. I remember an IJC meeting in which the International Joint Commission was looking at some of these issues and talking about feminization, for example, of alligators in Florida, which caused a reduction in male genitalia, for example, in alligators. Wow, boy, that became a great concern in the Great Lakes, because we had similar levels, for example, for PCBs and things. And, you know, that caused concern among the non-native population, but it disappeared really quickly. It sort of dissipated. And yet, boy, you're starting to tell your own people that these modifications and changes are occurring. And yet, you don't seem to get that high level of concern, because everybody's chasing after the buck.
We're right back to this matter of the differences between the two cultures.
Yep.
And it is so central. It's so much the very center of what we have been discussing, this matter of the Earth Mother and how you take care of her, and if what you experience as a result of that care being given, whether it's a healthy body and a healthy mind, or disease that comes from being exposed to chemicals that were not present in the Earth Mother, in the part of the Earth Mother that we are living in, ever before in all of time, except maybe in some cases at such low levels that our bodies were used to dealing with that quantity and it wasn't going to harm us. Where do we go from here, Henry? You know, what,
well,
as far as, you know, what do we talk about right now, but also where do we go in the bigger picture of, like, you know, the next 20 years, the next 30 years, the next generation, the next 100 years?
Let's not leave your listeners with the, you know, doom and gloom and weeping and wailing. What I would say to you is that, and this is something that I think I've noticed in the time that we've been working on these issues. When we first started working on the issues, the Mohawk people and their concern for this and their outspokenness with it were viewed as pariahs by the governments and by the people in the area. You know, you're yelling about the industries. My God, if those industries close down, we're all going to be bankrupt and we'll all be on welfare and it'll be a horrible thing. And you Mohawks want that to happen. You know, and we heard in the past, you know, that, oh, you guys don't know nothing because you're all ignorant, you're lazy, you're drunks and all of that stuff. You know, but what's happened over the period of time is as we've continued to do our work, whether it's good science or whether it's traditional knowledge, there are a vast number of people out there who have been listening to the message.
Right.
And the message has been, we have to get our lifestyle back into the earth so that we understand when these changes are occurring. And, you know, it's interesting me. 8PTN was here. I was speaking at the Stewardship Network in Michigan just recently, and there was a whole group of people there who were listening to the message and came to me later and said, you know what, we've been hearing this message from your people for literally centuries, and now I think we're understanding what you're saying. And suddenly, you're not like my grandfather. My grandfather used to say that when he was young doing the battling like I'm doing, he said he had to struggle in order to be human. And what we're doing right now with our people is to try to make sure that your people understand the implications of the things that the society is doing. And I think more and more people are understanding that. It takes a long time, though, to change people's ideas and beliefs. The dinosaurs are still out there.
Right.
So what I would say to you is there is, I am confident that with good work and good collaboration between your people and mine, we will create that mighty thing that will change this world. And how do I know that? Because we did it before. You know, I always use the example that when Thomas Jefferson and Franklin decided they wanted to create that better republic, who were the people they went to? They didn't go to France. They went to the Haudenosaunee people, and they asked us how we would establish a republic. So much so that in 1963, the American Bar Association and the Haudenosaunee scholars could see in the American Constitution exactly how Franklin had plagiarized a lot of our stuff and put it directly in there. The second place that you see it come to fruition in is in Das Kapital, the Communist Manifesto. And there, he didn't know how to spell it right, but he called us a primitive and primal society in North America who practiced a pure form of communism. And my grandfather used to say we gave the world the two greatest forms of government and you buggered them both up. But again, here's a simple people that are supposed to be savages living in the woods, and two great forms of government are coming out of that thinking. I think the next great thinking that will be coming from our people is this idea of how the societies can work with the environment and really make the earth our mother.
Yep.
So when people say to me, oh, nothing can change, no person can change this world, take a look at Russia, take a look at Tunisia, take a look at China, take a look at the governments that have been in power for 30 to 40 years and now are being shaken to the core. Take a look at the stock market and see how the economic stuff have been shaken. Well, this is big change time. And I think the message that the Haudenosaunee have to give about the world and how to live with it, I think its time has come.
I totally agree with you. And the one thing that I'm thinking about when I listen to your words is, okay, quite a number of people now, both, you know, your people in the beginning and leading the way, and now some of the people from the Western civilization are beginning to think this way of basically treating the earth like your mother and having a good result from that as far as health goes, and truly many things more than health. You know, it's just your attitude. It's your relationship with your community. It's like all those things you mentioned when you were talking about the corporate, you know, model for the First Nations. The one thing I'm thinking, though, beyond that is, okay, a lot of people know this, a lot of people thinking this, how does that translate into these actions being taken that are the actions of that kind of thinking? And so, and where I'm going with this is this thing that I always come to this thinking when I'm talking with good people about doing good things. I always come to this other part of this, and it's this history and this knowledge and this certainty, really. The bad people that have power do not give it up. They don't give it up. They have it, and they like having it, and they keep the power, and they keep the power, and they cheat, and they twist, and they try to convince good people that they're going to change and that they're good people and they're going to do the right thing and everything's going to be fine. But they don't. It has never happened in all the time. And it will be wonderful if it did happen now. But I'm thinking that the corporations that gradually amass so much power by exploiting the earth and your people and many other First Nations people and African Americans and, you know, many, many people that are in, like, weaker economies than the, you know, the most powerful of the corporations. Like you say, their own, you know, their own competition, you know, just this brutal battle for economic power that did work for a while. It worked for a while because you had a pristine environment to poison, so you could poison and poison and poison and get away with it. There wasn't much science around, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, developed science like you guys have developed there in your part of, you know, this world. Their, you know, scientific knowledge was very rudimentary. There wasn't, you know, they were way ahead. These corporate people were so far out ahead with just doing, you know, they weren't scientific about it. I'm not, you know, I don't mean for people to think that. They were just way ahead and just jumping in there doing things and, you know, the hell with it, you know, however they turn out is however they turn out. We made the money, you know, we're happy. But they have the power now. You are fortunate to live in a society which has a government that is based upon the principles that you speak of, and that does listen and is, you know, representative and is a good government doing what's good for the people because of what the people want. See, the society that I live in, this United States of America, they tell it, you know, to the kids in the schools and from the news media, lots of the news, corporate-owned news media, they tell one thing, that we have this representative government, and it's a great democracy. But what it ends up being, you know, the true facts of what it is that our government is, our government exists at the pleasure of the corporations. Our government is the corporations. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, for example, this federal government entity, which is right at the center of dealing with this matter of these POPs, these persistent organic pollutant contaminants of the environment and contaminants of animal fat because of the way they exist in the environment and the way that all the chemistry works out, our Food and Drug Administration will not take any substantive steps to reduce the POPs exposure of people that are consuming the commercially produced food supply, such a simple step as stopping poisoning the animals that you're eating. Food and Drug Administration will not act on a citizen petition that we've had before them since 2003. They will not ban this feeding practice of feeding waste animal fat contaminated with POPs to food animals, cows, chickens, hogs, poultry, fish, you know, fresh farm-raised fish. They will not prohibit that practice despite all we've been talking about in all these years of experience. And it's because the corporations rule them. The corporations say, no, don't do that. We can make more money feeding this waste animal fat, and what are we going to do with it anyways? You know, it's just waste. We'll turn it into money. by selling it to farmers to raise more food, and then people will eat that, and you know, help them. It doesn't matter if they get sick or if they've been getting sick, or you know, just all going to make us money. And that's the government that we have. So tell me this: how can we translate all these people knowing that the right path is the path that you guys are on, you know, this path of loving the Earth Mother? How do we translate that into forcing FDA to just like get out of bed with these corporations and do the right thing in this instance and many other instances? You know, you could sit here all day naming the situations in which FDA is doing what corporations want to the negative effect of the public health. You know, harm the public health, protect the corporations, keep the money, you know, just the big money rolling full steam ahead. You know, there's no need to do anything to protect these individual people's health. You know, the hell with that. How do we change with this number of people now? You got a number of people that care and that know the right thing to do. You know, protect your Earth Mother, protect the mother, so that all things can, you know, go well. How do we get the power away from the corporations and change and get the power away from, really away from the government too? That's, you know, right there an ally with, you know, it's like this, you know, well, in all the wars, you know, there's the allies. You know, say in the World War II, there was, you know, Japan and Germany in this quite, you know, I would consider it an alliance, and then the U.S. and Europe, other countries in Europe, the U.K. as allies, you know, Australia, lots, Canada, lots of countries, allies against this other side. Well, how do these people that know that we need to love the Earth and protect the Earth Mother, how can they form an alliance that's going to be successful in taking the power away from the corporations and the U.S. government?
Well, I would say to you that in my darkest hour at 3 o'clock in the morning working on some insoluble problem, you know, I could despair, you know, for what exactly what you're saying. But what gives me hope out there is doing exactly what you're doing, which is getting the word out, talking to people, allowing people to speak. 50 years ago or 100 years ago, you couldn't talk to the next village. Now I can talk to the world. And what interests me the most about the internet and the passing of information around the world is that this is a society now in which secrets can't be kept. Once they're out there, boy, whether it's WikiLeaks or whatever, there are people talking about the issues. And good, like-minded, and I believe that good will prevail. I look at and I see hundreds and hundreds of people discussing the same issue and same problem with a level of knowledge that was by far greater than perhaps what my grandfather or my great-grandfather had. And that knowledge is really very much, very, very powerful when it comes to changing these type of beliefs and ideas. And it takes a really very, very staunch dinosaur in order to be able to keep something going that just isn't right. And what I'm saying now is that, of course, we feel frustrated. We feel frustrated when, like, your pops in animal fats and things like this, or Akwesasne here with the 100-and-some-odd contaminants that come down the Great Lakes straight past Akwesasne, and we think that it should all be pure and clean. Well, it will not get any better if people don't talk about it, if people don't start standing up for what they believe in. And again, what the Haudenosaunee would say to you is that the ethic that you believed in the past, your people were also tied to the land. Your people were also tied to who you are and what you are.
Absolutely.
And you've sort of forgot that. You walked away from it.
Yep.
It's time to go back and revisit that. It's also time to, maybe some of the things weren't so good back then. That you know, the treatment of natives, the treatments of women. We can learn. We can learn to do things better. But you don't throw everything out. And in this new society, it's almost as if that's what we're trying to do, is to throw it out and reinvent ourselves. Well, some of our ceremonies were good. Some of our traditions are good. And we should keep those and hold those dear to us and make sure that we build on them.
The most valuable things that there are. all that time going by and people discovering these things and learning that they're valuable, and then to throw them away for like a CD with some like rock song on it or something like that. It's all crazy. The truth of it is, there's a lot of craziness. You know, let's not get into like discussing the craziness that, you know, just is another layer of this whole thing.
Yeah. I'm going to give you one other thing, and this is goes back to this concept of contaminants and pops and things like that. When we created a science, and the science said, well, let's go look at all of the pieces. So at Akwesasne, we looked at all the animals. We looked at the birds and everything in the plants. And then we said, oh, well, we can look at the people the same way. And when we looked at the people, the situation became very confused because it got closer and closer to us as individuals. Then I said, a group of us said, let's look at all of the native people in the Great Lakes. And again, the issue got vaguer because now you had so many different contaminants, so many different lifestyle situations, and so on and so forth. So it was really difficult to tease out where the implications were and so on and of the problems of contaminants.
Yes.
But where do we do the concept of the effects of contaminants on our society? We already have some thinking about this. I like Homer Dixon's work on the science of scarcity. But in his book on the science of scarcity, he talks about the relationship between population, between, the environment, and between the economic system. There's been a couple of books written on it. One's called The Soccer Wars. But what he did was he analyzed all of the conflicts in the world on the basis of those three things. And what he found was, as the population increases, you see that there's a decrease in the resources of the environment or a contamination of the resources of the environment. And when that occurs, the distribution of wealth shifts. And when that distribution of wealth shifts, you have conflict. Well, that's as plain as the nose you can get on your face. And here at Akwesasne, what you saw was, as the environment collapsed because of the seaway, because of industries, because of all of the things that occurred in our area, you saw the distribution system at Akwesasne change from a communal and traditional economy to a non-traditional economy that depended upon some nefarious types of things were going on. And in 1990, we had a revolution here in which Natives were fighting Natives, or Mohawks were fighting Mohawks at Akwesasne. That was inevitable. And what I would say to you is that we're carrying out a worldwide experiment doing the same thing. We're increasing our population. We're decreasing the resources that we have in order to live. We're calling it global climate change. Why wouldn't the distribution system shift? And when it occurs, you know that violent conflict will occur. So we know that. What are we doing about it? How are we measuring it? At Akwesasne, like I said, the Canadian and the U.S. government have spent something like $2.5 billion since 1990 to the present in order to police our area. Whereas if we were to take half of that money and put it into remediation of the pollution on the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes, we wouldn't be having the problem.
Right.
So we're using the old system of thinking and not incorporating in the new stuff. So societal pollution is that effect, but who's measuring it? Who's looking at it? And there I see is where I see some of the new work that's going to have to be done in the world. Because with global climate change, with this massive contaminants that we now have around the world has got much smaller, and we're going to have to deal with these type of issues. And maybe, just maybe, the Haudenosaunee have something to say about that.
We certainly do, and I'm glad that you told me about your revolution, because we want to have one here, and we'll certainly have to look into how you guys got yours done there.
Mm.
Thanks so much.
My grandfather used to say to me all the time when I got frustrated with the Western society, he would say to me, when your people first came to this country, you know, we extended the hand of friendship to you. and said, come and live on this land because there's lots of land here and we'll all be able to prosper. And here we are 500 years later and you're still on this land and we're still extending our hand of friendship and saying, now with all of these horrible problems that we have, we're still willing to work with you and your people. And what I'm hearing back from your people is maybe a cry that's even more profound, that's saying, tell us how to live here.
Yep.
And that's where I see our Savior going to be.
This is progress, Henry. We've gotten a lot of good ground covered today, and I really appreciate it. Let's wrap it up now. I like to keep these programs to about an hour because then I can use them on our radio station over Vermont. It's been so great talking to you. I wish you the best in everything you're doing. I'm glad you're very busy because I know you're doing a lot and you're moving forward with getting a lot of this progress made that we need to make. I'll do the best I can. My dad used to always say, do your best you can. And we're all doing the best we can, and hopefully that will be enough to shake these corporations to the point where they no longer rule here in the U.S.
I would say to you to just keep doing what you're doing, and how can they win? We're going to be here for 1,000 years. They're not.
That's right. Well, thanks, Henry. You are a great inspiration to kind of like not getting frustrated and to knowing that the good things will prevail and knowing that there will be great changes and that they're happening right as we speak, you know.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay. See you later.
Yeah, have a great day.
I will. Bye-bye.